You're listening to The Industrial Movement, where we discuss the people, the processes, and the equipment that drives American manufacturing. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The Industrial Movement podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and the show notes can be found at our website at www.theindustrialmovement.com. Come back often and feel free to add this podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow the show on Twitter at The Industrial Movement or on our Facebook page. All links to our social media can be found in the show notes and also at the bottom of our website. Now, let's get on to the show. Hi, folks. Welcome to The Industrial Movement. I'm your show host, Morty Hodge. With me, as always, my trusty sidekick, Greg Smith.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show.
Today, we're honored to have the founder of Reshoring Initiative, Harry Mosier. Harry is the founder of Reshoring Initiative. After being the president of a machine tool maker, GF Machining Solutions, for about 22 years, his awards include Industrial Week and AME Manufacturing Halls of Fame, SPE's Mold Designer of the Year, and Fab Shop Director's Manufacturer of the Year. He's participated actively in President Obama's 2012 Insourcing Forum at the White House. He's also a member of the Department of Commerce Investment Advisory Council. That's a mouthful there. Harry's spoken frequently at AME national and regional events for Shingo and Lean Frontiers. Harry's frequently been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, New York Times, and seen on national TV and radio programs. Harry, welcome to the Industrial Movement.
It's great to be here, Morty and Greg. Look forward to a fun 40 minutes or whatever we're going to do.
Absolutely. Harry, tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to where you're at today.
Okay. Grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, which is right across the river from New York City. And the biggest thing in town was a Singer sewing machine. At one time, like 120 years ago, the factory there was the largest factory of any kind in the world. It was 2.5 million square feet, 5,000 workers. It was a Goliath of its time. Obviously, a major portion of the town. And my grandfather was a foreman. My dad ran a third of the factory. He was an engineer and he ran different departments. And I worked there summers. And I went past 20 years ago and everything's gone. Nothing of Singer, as far as I can see, is made in the United States. It's all imported. And all those thousands of jobs, all that value was destroyed. And during my career, I sold foundry equipment and CNC machine tools. And industry after industry, company after company that I wanted to sell something to, they'd go out of business and they were driven out of business by the imports. The import was cheaper. Their costs were so much lower. They could actually create a better product cheaper because they had the low cost structure that left the margin to pay for the R&D and just drove many great world leading U.S. companies out of business. And so I said, you know, somebody has to turn this around. So that's my job.
Explain to us the vision and mission of Reshoring Initiative.
The mission? Yeah. Basically, to balance the goods trade deficit. So the goods trade deficit is about $1 trillion, at least it was last year. And it's gradually increased, $1 trillion. And balancing that will require, in other words, reducing our imports and producing the product here, exporting a little more, but mainly reducing our imports will require a 40% increase in U.S. manufacturing. That's 5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs. And then when you get that many manufacturing jobs, you get the multiplier effect jobs that add millions and millions more jobs. That's our mission, to make that happen.
How did we get in such a trade deficit?
Now, finally, the primary reason the companies source offshore is price. They didn't go there initially for quality. They didn't go for delivery. They didn't go for only available there. They went there because they could buy it for 30, 40, 50% less than they can buy it or make it here in the United States, because the wage rates there, say in China 20, 30 years ago, were 50 cents an hour. And the people worked hard. The companies invested. They eventually made pretty good products. And so they went for price. So we've surveyed it. We've asked companies, why do you source offshore? Overwhelmingly, the answer was price. A few say because the product isn't available here. And why isn't it available here? Because a low price competition drove the U.S. suppliers out of business. So the price was too high. And then the question is, why is the price so high here in the United States? know, why does Germany have wages equal to ours and yet have a trade surplus while we have a trade deficit? Relative to Germany, it's skilled workforce, where they have this wonderful apprenticeship system and lots of engineers. We don't have enough, anywhere near enough engineers being trained in the United States, because a lot of foreigners come in to take the courses. And we don't produce a fifth as many manufacturing tool and die, precision machining, et cetera, apprentices as we should. In Switzerland and Germany, 60% of the high school kids go into apprenticeships. In the U.S., 5%, and mostly into construction. So we don't have the pipeline bringing them in, and then we don't train them very well. Companies don't invest enough. In Germany, they invest more in machine tools. In South Korea and China, they invest more in robots than we do. Even though their wages are a lot less, they invest more in automation than the United States does. So it's a societal problem and a company problem.
What part does the government play in that?
Well, what we need is an industrial policy. Okay? The industrial policy says the country will decide its future in manufacturing, because manufacturing is so essential. Now, we have policy about agriculture. We have policy about, you know, all kinds of things like that. You know, music and art and, you know, university education. There's all kinds of policy. But in terms of industrial policy, the politicians, the economists have said, no, laissez-faire, let the market do what it will. And if we make one famous economist said it didn't matter if we made potato chips or computer chips. You know, it keeps people working. I don't care. That's obviously stupid. So we've had, if anything, a deindustrialization policy. If you said, what could we do to make the U.S. not price competitive? Let's say we'll have the reserve currency and let the dollar be 20 or 30% higher than it would be just subject to normal market conditions if we were not the reserve currency where every other country wants to store their money. We won't train our skilled workforce. We'll let everybody study music and history and art and fund them to do so, even if they never get a job to pay off the debt. We will we'll have the highest corporate tax rates in the world, which we did until 2017, except for maybe Japan. So a whole series of things. We'll not have a value-added tax. When you ship something into almost every other country, they apply a 15% tax to what we ship in, and then they give a 15% credit to what they export to us. We don't do those things. So that makes our product more expensive there and their product less expensive here. So we did everything we could do to destroy our industrial base, and we need to turn those things around. And when the government does that, I'll get my 5 million jobs. But I need help. So anybody in Washington who's listening, please act.
Let me ask you a question. How did President Trump do during his time versus President Biden now?
Well, I voted for Trump. And so I'm going to say some things that may sound, you know, negative, but I call them objective rather than negative. So he wanted manufacturing to come back. He talked about he pounded on the table and demanded that companies, you know, keep the work here or bring it back. But he didn't level the playing field. He didn't do the things to make the U.S. price competitive, such as reversing those anti-industrial policy things that I described. And finally, looking at the results, the trade deficit increased under his watch. So you say, if you ask a coach, was he a good coach? Well, he didn't have a winning season. Trump, in terms of trade, did not have a winning season. Now, in terms of Biden, let me say positive about Trump. He made the U.S. aware of the importance of manufacturing, aware of the fact that we should be self-sufficient. He started the recognition of the risk of being dependent on China. You know, he did a lot of things like that he deserves credit for, but finally maybe wasn't enough time, what have you. And he wasn't systematic and organized enough to fix the underlying conditions. Now, with Biden, you know, he came in at a time after the pandemic when it was clear that the U.S. is not self-sufficient on PPE, on medicines, on batteries, electric vehicle batteries, rare earth minerals, so, you know, just all kinds of things that it had all of a sudden become crystal clear to everybody. So he has reacted. And he's planning to spend tens of billions of dollars on the chip foundries. And it has to be done because we've fallen so far behind and we'll be too dependent. But he doesn't, and he's going to spend some on skilled workers. He can do some good things. But his administration does not seem to understand the basic problem that we're not price competitive. So my fear, for example, with the chip foundries, that right now we're dependent on China and Taiwan for chips. Okay. That's not good. But they're going to build these chip foundries, tens of billions of dollars. And it's recognized that our costs will be higher than their costs because our labor rates are higher, our building costs more, and all this. And so we're going to go from a condition of being dependent on them for chips to being dependent on them to buy our chips to make the infotainment systems and the servers and everything else that the chips are used in. And we're going to sell our high-priced chips to them. And if we're in conflict, you know, with China, then they're not going to buy our chips. And so if you want the chip foundries to be successful and booming and making money, then you got to bring back the assembly of the electronic products that the chips go into. And so it's this whole, we need a rising tide that lifts all boats. So the government says, well, we'll spend $10 billion here and $100 million there and do this. That's okay. But if you don't rise the tide, most of those investments are going to fail because eventually they won't be price competitive and they'll go out of business.
What about the tariffs that Trump instituted under his time? Did that help or hurt American manufacturing? We've heard it both ways, right? We've heard it helped. We heard it hurt. In your opinion, how did that end up?
Depends on where you sit as to how you see what's happened. And there's really two tariffs. There was like the steel tariff, steel aluminum tariff, and then there was the China tariffs. Okay. And concerning the steel aluminum, some people are avidly in favor. The problem is that by putting the tariffs on the imported steel, you raise the price of steel in the United States relative to the price offshore. And therefore, the people who use steel, probably your company, people who buy steel and make a product, when they have to compete with the imported product made of steel that's 30% less expensive than your steel, now you're not competitive. And there's more people using steel than there are making steel. So potentially, you've hurt more than you've helped. Now, if the tariffs have been applied to steel and all anything made out of steel, okay, then would have worked better. Ideally, if we had a value-added tax, which put a 15% tax on everything that came in, steel, things made out of steel, plastic, things made out of plastic, you know, then all these, the ability to hide goes away. On the China tariffs, they did help increase the flow of work out of China, but it was easy to move the work from China to Vietnam or Cambodia or Indonesia or somewhere else. Still China company, probably a lot of the components coming out of China, but the final shipment coming in from these other countries, thereby avoiding the tax. So again, if we had 15% tariff on everything, then there would have been no place to hide. Okay, so it's an all or nothing. You need it on everything at a fairly high level, like 15% forever, which is what all the other countries have, and it would have been successful.
So what was your motivation to start a reshoring initiative?
Well, it was, like I said, the Singer story, and I had an excellent career. I ran what was called Charmy, now it's GF Machining Solutions, EDM and high-speed milling machines. And when I took over Charmy, in 85, the company was number 7 in the industry in North America. 8 years later, we were number 1. You know, so it was the kind of career that anybody would say that was great, you know, unless you're Lee Iacocca, you know, or somebody really, really great. And so I'd been blessed to have such success, great team, great products. And so when I retired in 2010 from doing that, I said, well, here's this problem, this issue that nobody else is working on. Somebody's got to do it, and I'm elected. And it's been a lot of fun. People throughout industry appreciate it. I get contact feeling good about what you do and having other people appreciate it. It should be enough just to know you're doing right, but somehow it warms you up a little bit to have other people like it too.
What are the positive trends you're seeing?
The results. Now, first, when we started in 2010, in that year, the total number of jobs announced to come back, combination of reshoring by U.S. companies, think General Motors, or FDI, foreign direct investment by foreign companies, think Toyota or Siemens. The total was 6,000 in that year. And in 2021, in that year, 250,000 jobs announced going back. Now, driven significantly by the chip foundries and all this other, but it's been a nightmare, pretty steady like this going up. And so it's clear that the society, the consumer, the retailer, the manufacturer, the bigger companies, the OEMs, recognize the problem. They recognize that it does not make sense to not be self-sufficient, and they're doing it. Now, there's a limit. Right now, I assume your company, almost all manufacturing companies, have a shortage of workforce, skilled workforce, even non-skilled workforce. And it's true in all industries, not just manufacturing. Normally, it's just manufacturing. And so if I could bring back 1 million manufacturing jobs next week, there's nobody to do the work. Okay, so we need society to get on board and have more apprentice programs and more vocational programs, if you use that term, in the community colleges. You need companies to have the apprentice programs. You need people to recognize that manufacturing is once again a great stable career.
My next question is kind of selfish. Full disclosure, I own Hodge Compressor. We do manufacture industrial equipment. Even though it was designed and engineered here in Atlanta, Georgia, some of our products are made here. Some of our products are brought in from overseas. How can Reshoring Initiative help manufacturers that are listening to the show and myself?
Two things. First, in terms of the product that you're now importing, you could use our TCO, total cost of ownership estimator, which helps companies go away from deciding primarily on the basis of price. I can buy it or make it here for $10. I'm getting it from China or India or somewhere for $7. Obviously, go there. Instead, the TCO estimator helps you add in duty, freight, packaging, carrying cost of inventory, any special tariffs, et cetera, the risk of stocking out, intellectual property loss. And then when you do that, I reviewed 189 cases where users had done that comparing China to the U.S. And based on price alone, the U.S. won 8% of the time. Based on total cost, 32% of the time. And if there was a Trump 15% tariff, then 46% of the time. So what we can do, first, we can help you make better decisions about what you're sourcing now. Yeah? If you're not, maybe you're already doing that. That's fine. And then second, we can help you get more business. So we have something called the Import Substitution Program. So if you define the products that you're making by their HS code, that's the International Trade Characterization of the product. There's a 6-digit or 8-digit code for your kind of compressors. We can tell you who the biggest importers are of that class of compressor. There's company address, what tonnage or amount they're bringing in, whom they're buying them from offshore, some idea of what they're paying for them. And then we train your company to use the TCO estimator to go to those companies and say, hey, you're bringing this stuff in. We think you're paying, you know, maybe 20% less than we would charge. But we've done the math using the credible TCO estimator, and we think you'll be 5 percentage points better off buying from us. And you'll be able to sleep at night because you won't worry about ports shutting down and, you know, all the problems with geopolitics and so on. So we can help you buy smarter and sell smarter.
So what could companies do? I mean, how do we get them to look at this and make a change?
We document the trend. So we're putting out articles, a couple articles a month, getting interviewed very generously by you. We appreciate it. I give 60, 70 of these things like this and live conferences a year. So we're getting the message out. We're available to help, you know, companies that are thinking that, are, I mean, if companies are ever going to be concerned about their foreign supply chain, today has to be the time. It's just a matter, I think, of publicity. You know, by documenting this 250,000 last year, we're saying it's possible. In a broad range of products, it's possible. It's feasible. So it's worth the company putting in a couple of hours to do the math on a couple of problems that are their pain points, whether having quality or delivery issues. Take a couple of those and do the math. Use our TCO estimator, and maybe you'll be surprised. Say, wow, we're going to be more profitable by doing that. So all I can do is appeal to them, sort of in their sort of national responsibility, their societal responsibility to do the math. And then they'll see they can act in their own corporate self-interest.
Where do we go from here? After all of this, how do we move forward?
I think there used to be this view, I'm a conservative, but there's been a view in amongst economists, many politicians, that we shouldn't, that whatever the market does, it does, and it optimizes, and we all come out ahead. That's worked well for China and Mexico, and hasn't worked very well for the U.S. for the last 40 or 50 years. And so I think I read enough from economists and politicians that they've softened that rigid position, and they're more willing to consider things like getting the dollar down. And there's methodology, something called the market access charge that would do that. There's still hard to get a value-added tax, but obviously it should be done. Problem is the Republicans hate every tax, and the Democrats fear the value-added tax because it could raise prices if you don't do it right. And the lower income will bear the burden more than the higher income. And Democrats hate that. So, but every other country has done it, and it's obviously the right thing to do. A skilled workforce. I think there's been so much publicity about student debt and students who, half of them drop out of college before they finish. And of those who finish, at any point in time, about 30% of the people with a university degree are in jobs that don't require a university degree. They're working at Starbucks. They're working at a distribution center, doing something with a degree. In fact, I've got this great cartoon, and it shows a restaurant, and there's a long-haired, kind of ponytailed kid, washing dishes, and then three or four people sweeping and doing whatever, and they're all smoking. And the one of the older guys says, "Kid, all of us have PhDs in English history. Stop complaining." So to me, skilled workforce is the number one issue. And so I have two ways the government could do much better. About 8 years ago, the Department of Labor called me down to advise them on how to get the workforce ready for reshoring. We're in the Secretary of Labor's conference room. And I said, well, first we have to get the department to stop being part of the problem and become part of the solution. So I just took them right on like this. And they said, okay, what do you have? And I pulled up one of their charts, and I'm sure you've seen them. You have a bar chart like this, and it has income going up with number of degrees. Starts with no high school, it goes like that. And headline is education pays. And I said, I thought you were responsible for the apprentice program. So I thought you were responsible for us of the workforce we need to compete. Yeah, we do. Well, why don't you have in here the average income of people that have passed an apprenticeship and show that that's just as good as people with a bachelor's degree. And when you actually do the ROI and you don't have any tuition and you start working when you're 16 or 18, you're way ahead financially. Why isn't that in that chart? And they folded like this, and they didn't get quite what I wanted, but they got close on the chart. But there's still dozens of charts on their website and the Department of Education's saying, still with just the pure thing saying $1 million more lifetime income by going to university. And so that overwhelms the best job that you and I and the community colleges can do to try help people get into manufacturing. So we need the government to tell all the data. So I don't want to misrepresent anything, but instead of telling just the data that supports a university education, also provide the data that shows that there are other ways to win.
One of my favorite quotes or memes on LinkedIn recently was, normalize sending kids to trade schools after high school without making them feel like they're less than four-year university kids.
I talked to a fellow yesterday, I think, on the phone. Maybe it was Friday. He has a couple of small manufacturing companies, and he's starting a training center in Vermont, and where traditionally a good apprentice program followed the German model, and you start with a file, and you do this until you can make a perfect part with a file. And he's going to start them on five-axis programming and CNC machining. So instead of starting with the basics and working your way up, okay, and the basics seem pretty boring, okay? He's going to start with the most exciting, the robots and the five axis and everything up here at the top, and attract the really smart kids who want to do something exciting. So I thought, hey, I've never seen it done. I'll do everything I can to help you. And I hope he succeeds. Because the biggest problem is recruitment. If every high school, every community college had 100 kids lined up pounding on the door saying, we want manufacturing training, they'd give it to them because they want to be responsive. So if you can increase recruitment by making the training and the job sexier, then I'm sure that the training will work and we'll have the kids we need. But it's a mind shift for the country.
One of the things that I see is really trying to change the perception of manufacturing to the younger generation. And I think one of the things that manufacturers could do and should be doing is focusing on social media to overcome that stigma of the dirty manufacturing environment. Because you know, and I know, a lot of these places are like hospitals. You can eat off the floor. They're clean, air conditioned, bright lighting. And I think that's where we need to start to change that idea in this younger generation of what is manufacturing. Like you just talked about, that's exciting. Get involved with robots, and there's a lot of cool jobs out there. They pay really well. The benefits are off the charts. And I really think social media is one of the things that manufacturers are missing the boat on.
You prepped me up for something I wanted to talk about and something else I wanted to talk about. And you alluded a little bit to what's called the three D's that manufacturing is: dirty, dark, and dangerous. Okay. And I added to that disappearing because of offshoring and dead end. And I've read articles and surveys. So five D's. Okay. And so I've come up with five S's that replace the five D's and describe the reality. So shiny, safe, spotless, surging, steady, so five positive things. And I'm about halfway through writing an article that will, for example, on safe, I checked the government data, and manufacturing jobs on average have 10 or 15% fewer injuries and fatalities than all jobs. So it is safe. Okay.
Really?
Manufacturing.
It's incredible. I would not have guessed that.
That's my job to bring the data. Okay. So yeah. Manufacturing workers' incomes increase steadily throughout their employment. The actual manufacturing employment today, with ignoring the COVID dip, has increased steadily for 12 years. And today is 3 million higher than one would have projected 15 years ago. Because we've had so much more reshoring and so much less offshoring. So I've got the data, you know, that the guidance counselors hopefully will read. And then I'm going to do one general article, like for Industry Week, and have a picture of bright and, you know, like shiny and spotless, like you were talking about, you know. And then I'm going to offer it to each trade association or industry or state for them to put in the pictures of their best shops and then have them handed out to their students and their guidance counselors and so on. So we're going to create the fodder that will go into that social media campaign that you're describing. So I hope when it comes out that you'll help distribute it.
Yeah, our generation growing up, like Made in America, like that's what you bought, you know, and now it's about, they'll buy American as long as the price is competitive or similar. How do we change that consumer's focus on price and get back to the American?
Yeah. Most surveys, and it's always hard to separate surveys from reality, from behavior, but most surveys show 60 or 70% of consumers would prefer to buy a Made in America, and they don't want to buy a Made in China. And maybe 30 or 40% would pay 10 or 20% more for a Made in U.S. product, depending on what the product is. Yeah. And so from my viewpoint, the problem might be the consumer, but more so it's the availability of the product. So if I go to the store, a woman's clothing store, I want to buy something for my wife, and I've got to turn all the labels on 100, 500 garments to find one made in the United States. And after I do that for 10 minutes, I give up and I buy something that looks okay. You know? And so what I propose for any kind of retailer is a big sign with a big flag on it that says, ask us about our Made in US products. Okay. First, it shows they're committed to their society. That's good. And then when the customer comes up and says, yeah, tell me about that, they hand them a printout and it sells shirts, you know, aisle four, shelf three, you know, and you can find them made in America. And if enough people come up and ask for that, and if enough of them buy things made in America, well, they'll stock more things made in America, and then the whole thing gets easier. So that at the brick and mortar, I think that would help. I think availability and being reminded about it. Now, if I want a pencil, you know, most people want a pencil. I'm not going to expect them to drive all over town to find a made in America pencil. But like when I want a car, I will only buy a car assembled in the United States. I will not buy a car assembled anywhere else. And I do my best with appliances and the other things where there's a choice. And the more that consumers choose that, and the more that retailers and manufacturers make money, the whole thing can lift up like this.
That's a great idea. I hope the Walton family and Bezos is listening so we can have made in America sections and advertised in the brick and mortar and Walmarts and Amazon. Why don't we have those sections? We want to see those sections because I think it's somewhat their responsibility too to help advertise and give consumers an option. That's a great idea. So, Mr. Bezos, please, I know you're listening to this show, please make that change. We want to see on the homepage an option for Made in America products.
Yeah, they do have, there's some, you can find some information on those things, but it should be, I did some consulting for Walmart on their Made in USA program, although I always kid them it was for everyday low consulting fees. I was honored to help them, and they've done a great job of working to have more made in USA. But I've told them you ought to have it so that a woman, a buyer can come into the store and say, and she's planning to buy a baseball glove for her son, okay? And she comes in, she goes to the computer and says, no, we don't have any made in USA baseball gloves. Well, what other sporting equipment do you have for a 16-year-old boy that is made in the United States? Okay, nothing. How about clothing? You know, so something that helps her do her search, but always keeping the made in USA as part of the priority to find the product. Okay, so I think there's a lot that especially online that you could do to help with that, and at least online with every product to show the country of origin. And right now, you look at something, you don't know if it's made in USA, you don't know where it's made. I would say it should be a law that if you're advertising something online, the country of origin should be shown. And if that motivates people to keep looking until they find something that's made, preferably in the US, but maybe at least in North America or in Europe or somewhere instead of, for example, China, then we'd all be better off.
There are three baseball gloves made in America: Rawlings, Nakona, and Wilson. Nakona is made in Texas. Fantastic. I'm a huge baseball fan. You brought up baseball gloves. I wanted to educate the consumers listening that if you're looking for American-made baseball gloves, there you go.
Now, there are a lot of websites that just carry made in USA products. In fact, Don, I think it's Bruckner who runs Made in USA or Made in America, he's had trade shows and events, and they're starting a big website that intends to be the biggest website offering the most Made in USA products. So if you've decided you're going to buy Made in USA, then the question is, can you find what you want there? And if he succeeds, then that'll be great.
Okay, shifting gears here a little bit, focusing on the manufacturing leaders, so your plant managers, maintenance managers, just your typical leader in manufacturing, who is most of this audience. What can they do inside their companies to push these initiatives?
Well, the same things I told you about, convince the procurement people, the supply chain people, to use total cost instead of looking at price. You know, I've had cases where companies... say a machine shop. You know, they'll tell me, Harry, I've been to so-and-so, I try to sell them my product, and they say I can get it in China 30% cheaper. And then the salesman says, well, but I've heard about the warranty issues you've had and the quality issues, and you don't have any stock because you can't get it. And the procurement person says, that's not my problem, that's somebody else's budget. Okay, so you got to go around those silos and convince the quality department, the inventory control people, the marketing people, to lean on procurement or convince the general manager to take the responsibility away from procurement and say you have to look at total cost in making your decision. So that's how I would project it upward. And at the same time, encourage the company's sales force to use it when they're competing with imports, like I suggested for you.
Give us a few resources that helped you in your career that you think would help the manufacturing leaders listening to the show.
Now, I've not been much of a business book reader, not since I graduated. I got an MBA from the University of Chicago, so I got enough of that stuff when I did that and studied economics at MIT and so on. So I got a lot of good background. One concept, you know, that I read books on and apply consistently is return on investment. Looking at what's it going to cost me, what am I going to save because of it, and is the book worth the candle, so to speak? And I think it helps me think, I think, logically about things. In college, I studied economics. I used Samuelson, which was the book at the time, eventually a Nobel Prize winner. So I think that influenced my attitudes. And I read a very nice little book called Give Your Speech. And it made very hard, was very clear about it. It isn't make your speech, it's give your speech. So when you're talking to an audience, you're giving them something. And you should always make sure that the audience has what it takes to do something different, that something should change. If all they've done is listen and they go away and nothing happens, then it was a waste of everybody's time. But if you've given them the speech and you've given them tools, information to go back and do things better in their own work, in their own life, then that's a great success and you've achieved your purpose.
Give us some thoughts on how to debunk a myth about manufacturing.
That was what I said before with the 5 D's and the 5 S's. I think people think of it as a dead end. You know, it's manufacturing, at least for kids not getting an engineering degree, it was for the losers. It was for the kids that weren't smart enough to go to university. And I think increasingly it's for the winners that they will, those who make that choice and get the training. You know, and they can program robots and CNC machines and help design the automation of the factory. I was out at a NTMA, National Tooling and Machining Association conference last week in Costa Mesa, and several of the shop owners were talking about their workers who, with overtime, are making $100,000 or more a year. And yet, if you asked most guidance counselors about that, they say, in fact, I did a study once. I had lifetime income of people who've gotten an English degree, and the same for toolmakers, apprentices. Uh-huh. And the toolmaker starts making money sooner, doesn't have any tuition expense, and at the age of 40, and difference in income, always making more money, pay half of the difference in taxes, just to be conservative, and taking the remaining portion, investing at 7% a year. At the age of 49, the toolmaker had $1 million more net worth than the English major. Now, how many guidance counselors are handing that out? Nobody is, because they're graded and their high school is graded by how many of the students go on to university, not how many 10 years from now, 20 years from now, have a wonderful job.
Yeah, and a personal story, my brother-in-law graduated from the University of Georgia with a finance degree. He struggled for the first year even finding a job. And when he did, he actually made more money waiting tables at a restaurant than he would as his first year working in an industry, which is crazy to me. And like you said, these kids coming out of trade schools, which I am a product of a trade school, a four-year university was not for me. I chose to go the trade school route, and it was one of the best decisions I've ever made.
I've got a nice story about that. I was speaking up in Wisconsin, and I had a VP from Milwaukee Area Technical College, so a big community college, lots of trainees. And he brags about the fact that community college is the second largest graduate school in Wisconsin, because only Madison, the main campus for University of Wisconsin, has more people who already have bachelor's degrees, who at Milwaukee Area Technical College have come back to get a job where they can make enough money to pay off their student debt. Okay. So there's a lot of people that unfortunately too late conclude that the bachelor's degree was not the right solution, and that they need to get an actual skill where they can actually make some money.
Awesome.
Harry, one of our goals is to create a community of manufacturing leaders. How can some of these listeners contact or get in contact with you?
Well, the Reshoring Initiative, if you Google, you'll find that. It's www.reshorenow.org. I'm harry.moser at reshorenow.org. Okay, so you can email me, call me, ask for help. I hope you'll also report, companies will report their cases of reshoring, because if they do that, they can get the manufacturer's cool t-shirt, which we give to everybody who reports a case of reshoring we did not already know about. Because only by getting those cases can we tell you there were 250,000 jobs last year. Okay, so report the jobs, the reshoring you've done, either an OEM, who typically makes the decision, or the supplier, who often is the one making the components, you know, for the OEM. So report the cases. And if you, you know, see opportunities either to prevent offshoring or to enable reshoring, but you can't quite put it together, then you come to us for help with the analysis to make it happen. And let us help you with the import substitution program to find opportunities to get additional business by convincing your customers to reshore.
Harry, I think our hearts and visions are definitely aligned. It was a true pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you for joining us on the Industrial Movement.
Thank you, Morty. Thanks, Greg. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Well, folks, that's it for this week's episode. Be sure to visit our website, www.theindustrialmovement.com, to view today's show notes and get more golden nuggets of value that we have collected from manufacturing and industrial professionals in our archived episodes. On our website, you can also sign up for our newsletter and find links to join the Industrial Movement community on Facebook. The Industrial Movement podcast is where we discuss the people, the process, and the equipment that drives American manufacturing. I'm your host, Morty Hodge, wishing you great success.